You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, hey, hey! I'm sorry it's been a few weeks since I've personally greeted you all, but I'm bringing the intros back and so happy to be able to say that this week's guest is Spanish Love Songs. The band just released their album, Brave Faces Everyone, and have a few dates left in Europe before heading back to the United States to kick off a tour supporting the Wonder Years. And the hype is real. While their sophomore LP, Schmaltz, was my comfort album for much of 2018 into 2019, Brave Faces Everyone is a whole other beast. It has the band expanding their scope and getting heavier, both lyrically and instrumentally. Spanish Love Songs tackle mental health, mass shootings, income inequality, and plenty more of the stressors of living in 2020, and they do it in a way that can never be considered anything but authentic, as you'll be able to tell from this conversation. Without further ado, my talk with Spanish Love Songs. It's been super exciting watching the rollout so far with all the, you know, all the vinyl like selling out and everything. How's it been like feeling for you guys?
It's good. It's pretty, it's not unexpected, but it's beyond what we expected, which is really cool. When the label was like, yeah, so the first pressing sold out, I was like, oh, well, that's a good feeling. And then, you know, talking to our other friend who like, had talked to the label about how many to print, and he's like, I told them that wasn't going to be enough. I was laughing because I was like, well, I mean, I'd rather exceed expectations than undershoot them, so.
For sure. And I feel like it seems like you guys are kind of popping off just as much in Europe as you are in the United States, and it's always interesting to me seeing when that happens. I'm curious, like, what you kind of attribute that to, and like, kind of how the two like audiences differ, if at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I think a lot of that should just be attributed to the work that Uncle M put in on the last record, and then continuing to work this record with Pure Noise from a more PR standpoint. Mm-hmm. And we're super lucky. I think a lot of bands that are at our point don't have the response that we have in Europe, and it's been a real difference maker for us, because we can tour wherever we want and like not lose our asses completely, which is great. And the fan response, it's definitely different, but I mean that's the same as like every city is different too, the general response. But you know, in particular, like, mostly it just means I don't talk as much in between songs, because there's just nights where we'll be in Germany and I'll say something and it's just like crickets back to me. And the people after the show are like, we don't understand what you're saying. And you speak too quickly. And it's like, oh, okay. So, other than that, it's like, it's great. We have it's awesome fans and awesome response. And, you know, it definitely is quite cool that we get to go to Europe as much as we do.
Yeah, for sure. I've heard definitely like bands from Canada kind of saying that like being able to make it into the US is kind of like sometimes a challenge, and you kind of have to do it like right away. And I feel like it's kind of similar for bands from the US over in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we went to Europe for the first time in October of 2016. And so it's been a few years that we've been going over there. You know, we've gone over there as much as we've toured the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so when people are like, oh my God, how do you have that? Like, how do you get that kind of crowd on a Monday in rural Germany? And it's like, well, we've played a lot of really shitty shows, you know, the same way that we have here. You know, you play a lot of shows. That first tour was a lot of shows to like four or five people. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's one of those tours where you're like, do we want to do this? But I mean, it was a blast, but it was definitely one of the tougher ones that we've done because it was obviously, it was just starting out. It was our first time there. So I think, I agree with that. Just like having to put in the time everywhere. It turns out that like building a fan base isn't just easy. Like, what? No, that's hard, right?
I feel like I remember sometime like a little while after Schmaltz came out and kind of like when it was starting to, you know, spread a bit more, you all as the band kind of said how you're going to be, you know, refocusing on the band and kind of like throwing yourselves fully into it. And I'm curious how that kind of affected the way you went into like the writing and recording of Brave Faces Everyone.
Yeah. I mean, it's slowly been happening. I think when I said that, when Schmaltz was starting to do something, it was a bit optimistic. but it was almost like I could see the path forward, even if it was largely not there yet. But, you know, like I lost my job last year. Meredith lost her job. Trevor just moved back to Cleveland, you know, for like cost of living reasons. Meredith and I both left California. Kyle is somehow hanging on to his job, somehow miraculously hanging on to his job. And Reuben, like, has a really cool boss. So that kind of worked out. And so going into the album, everybody else got to stay in California and slowly keep working, right up until we recorded. So, and then we took like 3.5-4 weeks to do the whole album and like get it prepped for mix and stuff. So like we all had to take that month, or not all. Reuben got to work because like Reuben tracked drums in 3 days like a machine and he was gone. Super lucky. But I lost my job in like March or April and then have just been like picking up odd jobs here and there to survive. A lot of like manual labor jobs, which was, it was a great summer of like working and then feeling excited to get to play music. And so it was nice knowing that we were committed to it. So I took 3 weeks in June to write the album and then we went back to LA and then we spent another month, you know, doing pre-production and tearing the songs apart. And trying to pick up work where we could, but it was mostly focused on the album. So I think it definitely just allowed us to like see if this is something that we could do full time. And I mean, the answer is definitely yes. Now it's just a matter of like, when are we going to be allowed? When will we be allowed to do it full time? We're in a really weird spot right now where it's like I said, like most of us have lost or are losing our jobs. And we still don't make, you know, a ton of money from the band. So it's like how to navigate that kind of the dead zone of like, if you stop now, you will forever regret it. But if you go forward, like there's a definite like period of stress coming up.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. And I know in one of the interviews that I read, you kind of like mentioned how Giant Sings the Blues was kind of like leftovers from like, or like bits and pieces of like the last band you were in and some other stuff like that. I'm curious, did Brave Faces Everyone feel more like you were writing a sophomore album or like a third album?
Definitely more like a sophomore album. I think if we could, we would erase Giant from like, we're ashamed of it or anything, but because it was just an entirely different band and like we put it out, like we didn't give any crap about PR or about labels or about, you know, like playing shows. I think it was more just a race for, especially for like me and Kyle to put an album out and like say, cause up until that point, I'd played in bands that have only ever put out EPs. And I, looking back, remembered why we did that, which is that like your first set of songs are fine. But maybe you should take time to like develop and put out a few songs and develop a fan base and this and that instead of being like, hey, I've got 10 songs. Let's put out an album. Let's do it. Let's push it out now. And you know, but I like the album, but it definitely doesn't feel like the same band. And it'd be cooler for our story if this is only our, like, ooh, they really hit their stride on their second album, but, you know, it's our third, which is also fine. I mean, it's our own story to tell, but, it definitely felt more like there was no referencing Giant while we were writing this album. I was like, whoa, we didn't have to worry about covering any ground that we'd already covered.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about the kind of like evolution between Smaltz and Brave Faces Everyone. What was kind of like what made that difference between Giant and Smaltz?
I mean, between Giant and Smaltz, it was just coming together as a group and me getting more confidence as a songwriter and just spending more time on it. And then bringing Meredith in on the key side of things. And then, so of course, on between Schmaltz and Brave Faces now, it's the same type of thing. Like, we got even more time to spend together with it. We've been a band for 2 extra years. Like, I now consider myself maybe a songwriter. Like, like, this is what I tell people I do now instead of saying it's just like a hobby. And then we brought Trevor in as well. And like, so it's just a whole, all those things kind of come together and it just pushes it in a new direction. And I also think that we had like a very like real reaction to the fact that like some people enjoyed Schmaltz, and, I never want to do the same thing twice. So I was like, oh, people like that. Let's not do that again. Like, let's try to find a way to twist it. Not to say that like this is a new metal album or anything, but I would say it's a pretty different album, like sonically and pace wise. I think there's a lot of stuff that we do well, but it's trying to push it beyond just like, here's me shouting about hating myself over, you know, like a pop punk drum beat and some riffs or something, you know. And so some people will hear that and be like, that's bullshit. You're still just a pop punk band playing pop punk songs. But, you know, we tried to push it in ways that were interesting to us.
Yeah, for sure. I think part of what kind of helped set it apart for me was it feels like you guys spent a lot of time on like the transitions and how songs flow into one another. Was that something like intentional on your part?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think in a perfect world, I'll write an album that's one giant song, but I'm not there yet. I'm not that good yet. So like we're, you know, it's just something we always were conscious of, is like how things will fit together. And you know, like sound designing in a way, you know, Meredith and I are super interested in film scoring and stuff like that. So, you know, a lot of it was sitting down and being like, oh, how can we use the synth to carry over into this? Or how do we do that? So it was, you know, it was a lot of fun trying to figure those things out. And like, we didn't give them as much thought as I would have hoped we could have. Like, we just ran out of time. But it's definitely something on our minds. And as I was kind of writing just the like bare bones of the songs, I already, like, I had an idea of how they needed to flow, just like from story to story, and to try to build, you know, cause there's a narrative to the album, but it's not like, I would say as straightforward as like Schmaltz was, just cause there's so many different stories that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But kind of building it up so that it made some sort of sense. We definitely don't want to put out an album that feels just like a collection of 10 songs. Mm-hmm. I believe I'm a firm believer in like the emotional impact of an album as a whole. I very rarely will put on an album and listen to 2 songs off it and then switch to, like, I'm not a playlist person. I hate it so much. Which is not good in the modern world and like the age of Spotify. But I, you know, there's nothing less satisfying to me than when I hear a song I like and then that song ends and I'm waiting for that next hit of the next song to come in and then it never comes and it's a completely different artist. Like, that drives me insane.
Yeah, I'm definitely a very similar way. Like, unless a playlist is like created like by me with like a specific intention, then it's like, then I'll get to know it exactly like an album.
Yeah. I find something so, like, maybe just playlists remind me of being in high school and writing, making like emo mixtapes for like girls I liked. I don't know. I don't like the idea of other people trying to curate my life. Like, and I know there's some people out there who are like, just curate everything for me. Tell me who I am. Tell me what I listen to. Like, I have no offense to people like Imagine Dragons, but like, that feels like music that's been curated to like be cool to a lot of people. I don't like playlist rock. Like it's not. I'll stop. I don't know.
No, I definitely know what you mean.
I'm cranky. Yeah, no, I'm kidding.
And I mean, going off that idea of curation, I mean, if you were to say, like, who would you say like you're curating your music for?
I mean, on like the basic level, we're curating our music for us, right? And we're writing songs that we want to hear, and we're trying to be the band that we want to be, and we're aiming for bands that we like, you know, and or like not even bands that we like, but like mountaintops that we seek to conquer, like musically, and just trying to do our thing and push it as far as we can. And so beyond that, we've always kind of said, like, we're going to sit down and write this album that we want to write. And if people like it, that's really cool. Like, you can get on board this train and like this train, and then you can get off this train. And like, if from now, a ton of people won't like us who liked us now. And that's just like, that's just the course of life, and that's musical change and stuff. So, you know, it's the same way with like people who are like, I only like the artist's early stuff. Like, that doesn't any worse than the early stuff. It's just that you've changed, you know? So all we can ever do is try to curate like what we want to listen to, and hope that other people will respond to it and get on the train and choose it for themselves. You know, or like a song will be on a playlist and they'll hear it and like be interested enough to click through to our album and actually listen to us, which our fans largely do. And I really like, to me, that means that people are getting it. It might not be as many people as like cool bands. but I'd rather like play the people who get it. You know what I mean? Like I'll notice like we have like not as many monthly listeners as like a band should have in this day and age, but we have a shit ton of minutes streamed. So I'm like, oh, people are just listening. And that's really cool. And that's all I really care about. Like, we just want to connect with people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was going to say earlier, actually, too, like that, I feel like the best thing about like plays are best used, in my opinion, as like a discovery tool. And like you said, like clicking through and then, you know, really discovering the artist. And it's funny you mentioned like how many minutes are being streamed and stuff, because you were my second most listened to artist last year, according to the Apple Music stats, at I believe it was like 46 hours or something like that.
Oh, that's so cool. See, like, I appreciate that. I'd rather have like one person listen for 46 hours than 46 people listen for an hour. I don't know.
Yeah, like,
to me, it means more, because like the person who's listening for 46 hours is going to come to the show.
For sure.
The person who wants their life curated with music, because that is just how society is now, and you hear music everywhere you go because the availability of music, and you just expect to hear music in the background. That person's not coming. Like, I don't want to generalize, that's mean, but like, largely those people, I don't think are going to love like coming to see our band and supporting our band. And maybe they do. I don't know. I'm on one right now. I'm sorry.
Those are probably more of the emo man people.
Grumpy afternoon. Yeah. Not that it's like, it's a weird situation. It's like, I'm happy when anybody listens, but of course I want like the diehard people to listen. Who wouldn't want like people who get what you're going for, I guess, to listen, you know, like that's cool. And everybody else is like icing on top.
Yeah, for sure. As far as the career wise, those are the people that are, you know, easier to convert into the more substantial stuff too. So it makes a lot of sense on, you know, the emotional and the business side.
Like stupid hypothetical games sometime. And somebody was once like, would you rather like cap out being a band that plays to like 20,000 people, but you only get that for like 5 years, or you play to 500 people for the rest of your life? And I was like, 500 people the rest of my life. That'd be so wonderful. And like, so that'd be a gift. You know what I mean? So like, it's largely the same thing. It's like, quality over quantity. Which is counterintuitive to how you should run, you should run a band business, I guess. But like, I'm sure other people who are now involved in our band hearing me go, oh, fuck the numbers, they're probably just like cringing, like, you dumbass.
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely like kind of that, the balance between like you said, like popping off for a short period of time, or like the longevity. And I think in a lot of ways, the longevity kind of pays off in the end. So
absolutely. Yeah. The longevity absolutely pays off. And like, especially when you can have longevity without having to dip into nostalgia.
For sure.
That's like truly, that's like you've made it at that point, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And you had mentioned kind of like the fact that there's like multiple story threads throughout, the album. And I feel like there, at the same time, there's like also a lot of like really great one-liners that like stand out to me a lot. Was that something that you like intentionally tried to have a balance between, or did it kind of just like, is that just kind of like how it ended up happening?
No, I think that's just how it happened. I truly try not to think about one-liners when I'm writing because I think it drives me insane. Like, holy shit, how did you come up with that one line? You know what I mean? Like, Phoebe Bridgers is like the ultimate, like current person doing like just one line after one line that just wrecks you. And you're like, oh my God, how did, you know what I mean? I was definitely more focused, and I like have to, or else I'll lose my mind. I'm just like, I don't, I'm still figuring out how to be a good enough writer to like sit down and tell a coherent story half the time. So I'm just like, does it say what I need it to say? And does it fit into the meter of the song? Cool. But that's great. I'm glad there's some, obviously I know there's one liners that will stand out to people. And that feels good, but it's definitely not like forefront of my mind. Usually that's kind of the rest of the band's function. Like the rest of the band would never, I won't say never. There's definitely been times there's like an understanding for me to change a lyric. I'm gonna flip on you, like like what did you just say to me about this really hard thing I just did, in like a not like a mean way, but just like,
yeah
I'll just be like, I don't give a shit, shut up, this is the song. But they are very good at being like, yo, that line's dope, like push that, or like let's highlight that, or you know, something like that. In like a much more positive way. And then occasionally they'll be like, hey, why don't you change a word or something? Cause that word doesn't work. And we've finally built up, Kyle and I especially have a level of trust like that when we're working in the studio, that he can be like, that line's not working. And then I will react a little bit softer. But that took a while to get to, just cause it's like, I don't think of myself as a very good guitar player, and I don't think of myself as a particularly amazing songwriter, but I do have an ego with the way I can string some words together on occasion. So it's been, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I knew this was an album that I was going to connect to, but it did kind of take me like a few listens. Like, it was kind of like this morning when I was listening at work, and like, for some reason I was just like keyed into the lyrics even more, so like the kind of the force of the album hit me rather than like the one-liners, which initially were what kind of like stood out to me more. So it's kind of interesting that's the opposite way for you.
it's definitely an album that like in a perfect world you'd sit down and read the liner notes along with it. Like the lyrics as you're sitting and listening to it on headphones or like on your stereo, which I feel like is a lost or a dying art. I remember being young. It might just be not lost, but I'm just not young anymore and I don't have the time to do it. But I used to love just cracking open a CD and listening and reading along. It was like the ultimate book on tape. You know what I mean? Like, it was great. Like in a perfect world, that's this album, but, we're not, you know, we're very aware that that's not how a lot of people consume music anymore. So I think you're right. Like, there was a push to emphasize like catchiness, for the first time. Like Schmaltz is definitely like, get the idea out. Does it work? Cool. Let's move on. Whereas, you know, this, it's funny you said that, like you were waiting to connect with it on like a deeper level, but you enjoyed it on a like surface level because it's definitely like more traditional song structures. And I like one of the complaints that we not had or heard, but like something that came up a lot on Schmaltz is like, there's no choruses, you know, it's just like songs that kind of run together. So of course this time I'm like, I could write a fucking chorus. And so I think every song has a chorus now, you know what I mean? Which I think that helps too, with kind of like, And that was something I wanted to do, you know, try to get into more traditional songs and see there, because figuring out what we do well and ways to push it into interesting ways, or ways to push it interesting ways, ways to push it into interesting places. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of figuring all that out and simplifying. I think this is an album for us about kind of simplifying what we do and not being, just kind of crazy and all over the place.
Yeah.
And kind of awkward and just wandering, just kind of, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think
kind of all over the place, I think.
Yeah. I think that makes sense, because like Schmaltz is like, you know, it's like a ride. Like as soon as you're going, you're like, it's like nonstop. Like you're kind of just swept up in it and like, you know, the craziness of it. But like this album, it's like a lot more kind of like almost like substantial in a way, like sonically. Like I feel like it's heavier both like lyrically and musically. And like you said, like the more traditional song structures, it just like kind of, to use like the meme term, like it hits differently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that was definitely intentional. It's definitely more deliberate in its pacing and, like I said, in its structure. And heavy, I'm glad you said that. That was definitely like, as soon as Trevor joined the band, like between me, Trevor, and Meredith, like, so that's 3/5 of the band. Our favorite bands are heavy bands. You know what I mean? Like, on top, like, other than my eternal love for, like, Bruce Springsteen and stuff like that, the, like, mine and Trevor and Meredith, like, commonality comes together on bands of like a much heavier background, you know. Mm-hmm. Like when Trevor and I are driving, or if Trevor's driving and I'm in the front seat, like you bet your ass Every Time I Die is getting put on or something like that, you know what I mean? And the rest of the band groans in the back seat, or like, you know, we grew up and we still love Thrice and, you know, bands like that, or Manchester Orchestra and stuff like that. So definitely kind of like that fun to be able to kind of expand into that. And what's funny is on Giant there was one song called Stranger that was us kind of messing around in that world, but nobody else really enjoyed it besides me at the time, I think. So we kind of like killed it and put it away. So it's nice to like open that toolbox up again and be like, you know, I don't have to be shouting over every musical bar. So like, what happens if we take a break and just let the music go for, you know, for a section?
Yeah. And I guess going back to the idea of like the multiple storylines and the connections, I mean the two pairs of songs that like obviously stand out as related would be Self-Destruction as a Sensible Career Choice, with Optimism as a Radical Life Choice, and then Losers Part 1 and 2. Could you talk a little bit about like those songs and the connections that they have with each other and how they fit into the album?
Yeah, that's funny, because to me, Self-Destruction and Optimism to me are only linked by the titling structure, I guess, which was definitely like, it was just me being cute, but in like a very serious way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that those two songs are linked in their kind of look at this overwhelming kind of hopelessness mm-hmm. that me and some people I know have felt from time to time, and knowing what a drag we can be, and hoping that that doesn't make us, unlovable for lack of a better term. Like I know I can be a drag to be around, and, you know, and, Self-Destruction is more of a story about, you know, somebody wanting more, than their simple life, that phrase, it'll get better. You know, that's like where it won't be this bleak forever. That's where that comes from. Which somebody actually said to me, like the chorus of that song was like a very literal response to somebody saying like, it won't be this bleak forever. And I was like, yeah, sure. Like, whatever. Yeah, right. You know? And yeah, right was the title of that song for a very long time. And then, you know, Optimism is the flip side of that, of like, hey, the world's ending, and I know I'm pointing this out to you on a daily basis, and I just want to run away and hide, and like, I know I'm a lot, but like, please don't leave me out here alone, you know. Mm-hmm. Losers 1 and 2 are actually, yeah, it's like a true sequel song, because we've definitely had companion songs in the past, but like I think this is the first like true kind of sequel we wrote, just because I wrote those lyrics as one giant song originally. And it was one batch of lyrics and then a few other outlying things and some stuff I had to tweak. But so the chorus of Losers 2 was the original chorus of Losers 1. And we loved it. Like, it was a completely different meter and stuff. And everybody was like, oh, that's such a cool chorus. And then, like, as I often do, we were getting ready, like, we were working on it the day before we were going to record it for the EP. And I was like, this chorus sucks. We can't do it. And then I wrote the new one for Losers, which is great. I love that chorus. I think it's like some of the best stuff I've done. But I didn't want to lose the other one. And so when we had the song and we had the beat and the kind of structure to the song, and I was really struggling to like find something for it. And I remember that I had this other half of lyrics that I had excised. So there's like Kyle has a big running joke with me because he's like, and show the engineers my lyric sheets, because it's like the one page of the lyrics we're doing and then like another two pages of stuff that I've just like not used and like cut out and been like, I have it but I don't know where to put it. So I finally had somewhere to put it, and so those are two different sides to the kind of same story, and the feeling of like economic hopelessness, right? And I have been saying, because Losers 2 is the next single, it'll be out on Monday.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, and so I had to do like the PR quotes for it, and I've been saying like Losers 1 is like the party anthem. It's like, yeah, fuck you, we're losers forever. But Losers 2 is the like the hangover from that, which is like, what does that actually mean? And like, where do we go from the only place you know is nowhere, you know?
You kind of said how it ended up becoming two separate songs, like when you're like getting ready to go into the studio, you're kind of like just like tossing half of the song. But like, why didn't it end up, when you brought it back in, why did it still continue to be two separate songs instead of like meshing back into one?
I mean, honestly, because we needed another song. So I'd rather have a part two of a song that connects lyrically. It also made sense because we were debating whether to put Losers on the album. Because we'd already released it, you know, and mm-hmm. and we love that song. We were really happy with it. Like, despite some challenges on the production side of just like running out of time, like that was when we were all still working, like trying to keep our jobs. And so like Kyle would work like an 80-hour week, and then that weekend we had to record that EP. You know what I mean? So yeah. He was just burnt, and I was burnt, and so like it wasn't fun. But we were like really happy with how that No Reason to Believe turned out. I had all these songs, and I started putting the Losers 2 on there, and we were debating whether we wanted to put Losers on the album, because it made sense contextually, like as a song, you know. That Losers was like the beginning of this batch of songs that I was writing, like thematically. And so there was a big push to get it on. I mean, obviously the label really likes that song too. It's a fun, catchy song. And there was like there was a lot of people being like, we like the song, you should put it on the album, it's a good song. And us being like, well, we don't want to repeat ourselves. But it did start to make sense in the context. And then by the time I decided to make that song Losers 2, then it like fully clicked, because it's like, oh, well, now in the context of the album and even sonically, the way that they kind of shift, it like has to be on there. And not only does it have to be on there, it gives us an excuse to re-record Losers when we're not totally brain fried. And when we've been playing the song for a year and we like know what it is. And then, so it gave us a chance to like do it better and do it better justice and also make it kind of reinforce the theme. So I think it kind of worked out in keeping it separate. It kind of worked out and really gave us a kind of, it ended up being a 2-for-1. Kind of opportunity, because I think without Losers 2, I don't know if Losers, so then we're pulling into some of the B-sides that we left off, and I'm not happy with that album. So like I'm happy with this album, so it kind of worked out. and that's still, Losers 2 was still a nightmare, because we got into the studio and I didn't have the second verse, I had Lyrisphere, but I couldn't figure out how to make it work. And we were like taking my vocals, and I don't get that embarrassed in the vocal booth anymore, but I was just fumbling over this verse. And I told Kyle to loop it and everybody to just leave, like go away for an hour and go eat lunch or something. And I wrote that second verse in like an hour of just one lining over recordings of myself trying to figure out, what worked. And then they came back and I was like, and it's funny because I think that second verse is my favorite batch of lyrics on the album. But it was like, I hope it's fine. But it ended up working out. But yeah, it was a stressful song, and it, like, I think really was a big turning point in terms of getting the album where we wanted it to go.
Awesome. Yeah. And just one more thing on Losers. I'm curious. You mentioned kind of like your brains being fried during the original recording, and obviously this being a re-record, and how it ended up being like kind of like a half step up. Was that, was it a half step down because your brain was fried, or is it a half step?
It's a really dumb story. We recorded it. So we usually record everything a half step down. So it's called E flat standard, or D sharp, whatever you want to call it. It's pretty common tuning. And I was toying with the idea of going even lower. So Losers and No Reason to Believe were actually recorded. No Reason, it doesn't matter because we use the capo on it anyways, the tuning up. But I toyed with going a full step down. So we recorded it that way. And it was cool, except I found I had this tendency to like push the vocals in weird places that I wasn't used to. And it was making me like a little whiny. Which you would think like lowering, I would sing lower, but for some reason when we lower it, I just want to go even harder. I don't know what that effect is, but whatever. So when we're recording it, the rest of the album again is a half step down. And I mean, it sounds like we were so sloppy, but Trevor tracked bass and he did it a half step down, mostly because none of us thought to tune it down because we never do. And then we listened back and we're like, I kind of like it. and then we were like, this will be really funny. Because it'll justify the redoing it. It's like back in its contextual tune. I worked it out in my head before we like committed to it, but when we heard the bass, not the original way, but in the new way, and I was like humming along with it, and I was like, I think vocally it's going to be even better because I'm going to actually, because I pushed it so hard when we wrote it the original way, it's a half step up. Now I have to push it even harder. And thankfully, like again, when we took the vocals for the original Losers, like my voice was shot. Like I don't know what was like. Again, we were just so burnt. I did the vocals in the studio and they were so bad, that I retook them in Kyle's sister's bedroom, where we were recording like some like pickup stuff. And so like, I just remember my voice being so bad. So then this time I was like, oh, cool. I can do this justice. And now I have to push it even harder, and like sing it in a much more creative way. So I think it kind of turned out that way. So it's kind of a running joke that like I think I tweeted about this, like how we messed up in the studio. It was a mess up, but it wasn't as out of control as I made it sound. just cause I like making fun of us, and Kyle and Trevor. I think they're like, you know, dude, why are you making us look like idiots in the studio? And I'm like, well, we weren't actual idiots, but like it was a funny moment because we could have just easily just retracted the bass. Like it would have taken us 20 or 30 minutes. Trevor's an amazing bassist, and like we know that song pretty well and we had the tone, but just being like, ah, let's go with it. And that's the kind of like fun stuff that, it's such a dumb thing, but that was kind of emblematic of our time in the studio, which was like, let's just try to have fun with it. Like it's a gift that we get to be here for like 3 weeks straight recording, so let's do it, you know.
For sure. Yeah. And it's definitely like a fun story to hear, and like I feel like you said, kind of like justifying the fact that it was released as a single and then is also on the album.
Well, also it would have been super weird because see, this is like some musical nerd. I don't think a lot of people will stress about the way that I stress about it. Like every song on the album is in one of two keys, and so if you had put that another step down, it would have been the only song out of key on the album, and I think it would have been very weird and very noticeable. And I think part of the way that the album is able to flow together so well is that, like, a lot of the songs are in the same key. And that was very intentional because I wrote the first batch of like 6 songs and I said, oh no, guys, these are all in this one key. And I said, that's going to be a problem. People are going to think we're simple or stupid. And the band was like, shut up. see it as a challenge. Like, try to do an entire album without changing too much. There's something nice about restricting yourself and being like, if you're in this key, then it's like, these are the chords you get to play, you know, mm-hmm. So like, how to change them in an interesting way. And simplifying, right? So like, we don't need to have an album in 10 different keys playing every chord that we can, like, you know, being all crazy and all over the place. Like, we can I think it ended up working out that way. And now it's a fun way to mess with people. Now people are going to be listening. When the song came out, I like immediately saw people asking, it's like, what the hell is happening with Loser? Something different about it, but we don't know what. I mean, I have stuff noticeable, but like, if you're not paying attention, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's always so interesting to me to like hear like the music theory reasons behind stuff that like, as a non like musician, like that, like you pick up on just kind of like natively.
Yeah. And I mean, we're not like a pretentious band. Like, we're not, I can talk about all this music theory stuff all I want. We're not like a musically intensive band. Like, we know what we're doing and we know it's not crazy, but you know, again, I see that as like a rising to the challenge of, you know, rising above our limitations as musicians to do something, more interesting, you know. And, and I started playing on a piano and I played Born in the USA. And I realized that song is 2 chords the entire time. And I was like, well, now I have to write a song that's only 2 chords. Like, I have to try to rise to this challenge of like, how do you be interesting without changing anything? You know what I mean? And I think you can see that in a lot of the kind of, some of the stuff we're doing, and trying to, yeah, I guess rise above what we perceive as our limitations.
Yeah. And then, so another song that I kind of wanted to hit on, is Dolores, which I feel like is kind of, as far as like the
that's
subject.
That's my 2 chord
song. So perfect segue, I guess. and I feel like that one's like, as I read it, at least like about like mass shootings and kind of like the.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so like the lyrically, I feel like it's kind of one of the heaviest songs on the album. So I was just curious to hear a little bit about that and the way that one came together.
Yeah, so there were like 3 sticking points in the recording that like really, really made us want to kill each other. So there was Losers 2, which had a pre-chorus that we cut, and the second verse, and making that work. And then there was the bridge of self-destruction, which like I couldn't figure out to save my life, musically and lyrically. So, and the unfortunate fact that like we had tracked drums for all these things. So there was a lot of very creative editing going on to like make everything work, and a lot of retaking of some little drum parts and stuff like that. And then there was Dolores. So Dolores, like during pre-production, was, and maybe I'll release like a clip of it someday, but it was like a mid-tempo kind of Americana rock song with like this bouncy chorus. And we tracked it that way and we really liked it. Even though we thought it sounded a bit like a country song, like the working title was like Country Road as a joke. And like, unfortunately, it stayed that way when we sent it to the label, and so everybody kept calling it Country Road, and I was like, oh, god damn it. And then we got into the studio, and we started tracking drums, and the day before we were going to track drums, Ruben and I ran through everything one more time, and we played it, and I was like, this sucks. This is not a good song.
That sounds like a pattern for you.
Yeah, it drives everyone insane. And I had like a little reverb pedal that I just got, and I was messing around with it, which it didn't even end up on the album, but I played a version with just 2 chords, just me. And Ruben immediately was like, yeah, so we are going to do that one. Like, that's what we need to do. And the rest of the band was like working on stuff back in Kyle's apartment. And we got back there and said, we're idiots. Why would we change this thing that we already have that we pre-produced? Like, the point of pre-production is to practice the songs. So then when you get the dry run, so you go to the studio, you know what you're doing, right? And you can explore things instead of trying to figure out the songs. And so, like, we were recording drums in Orange County, and I have like a little production like groove box, and I was like recording organ pads on it and structuring it and doing like little drum loop. Like, people thought I was crazy. And so our last day recording drums, we set aside half the day, and Ruben and I fleshed it out. And that kind of took its structure that way. And then from there, it all kind of fell into place and became what it is, which is not a upbeat country song.
And as far as like lyrically, I feel like it's, like I said, it's like really hard hitting. And I think it's one of the ones that, like, when it finally, like, hit me, like, it really hit me hard. How did that, like, the lyric side of things come together for you?
You know, I was just writing. I went off on, like, it was one of the last things I wrote lyrically for the album. I think it was that and then Kick. Like, those were the last two things I did. It was just something I had written down. And I know on Schmaltz, we had a song where I was trying to tackle a similar subject. And when we got into the studio, I scrapped the lyrics completely because they were bad. And that song became El Nino Considers His Failures. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was a completely different song about, like, mass shootings and America and stuff like that. And I struggled for a long time to find a way to talk about it in a than somebody like being at a song being like, guns are bad, you know? Like, no shit. Like, I don't know. And so I found a way in, which is just through a story of nurses working, you know, working the shift after a shooting. I remember I wrote it down because we're all working, and it was when the Texas shootings happened this year, like the back-to-back shootings. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, cool. Like, here we go. Here we are again, another album, and, you know, all the same shit's happening. And so it was just, yeah, it was a way to kind of get into it and just kind of vent some frustration. And just tying into the theme of the album of like, just empathizing with people who are seeing it from another perspective and another side. Mm-hmm. You know, and largely working in a place where, like, I mean, that story ostensibly takes place in Texas, right? So, like, working in a place where people probably aren't as anti-gun as I myself might be, but still seeing the kind of ravages that these things wreck on humanity, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think kind of, like, having it from, like you said, like, the point of view of, like, a nurse is, like, it kind of humanizes it differently in a way, and like offers like that other side of things that kind of like makes you look at it. It makes you like pause and like look at it differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause like it's easy. Yeah. It's easy to distance yourself from these things. Like, oh yeah, guns bad, you know, this, that. But like thinking about the human toll that a lot of these things take, has been, you know, a growing experience for me as well. And just, like, it doesn't just end with, yeah, it like, I mean, obviously it starts and ends with a bunch of, you know, usually with a bunch of dead people, dead at the hands of some, you know, deranged asshole. I don't even want to say deranged because that makes it sound like it's a mental health thing. You know what I mean? Some asshole. Yeah. With an asshole with a grudge, right? Or a white man with a grudge. Yeah. I forget my own lyrics. You know what I mean? You see this pattern, you're just like, what the hell? And it starts and ends with the victims, but it also goes beyond that, you know? Yeah. And the consequences are further reaching than just us, you know, saying, yeah, guns are bad because 10 people died. Well, like 10 people died, but then this happened and this happened. You know what I mean? It all kind of stacks up.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's something that like isn't always considered. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, it's hard to consider it. You know, it's the same thing with where we are now with like this Iran situation, war with Iran, and people joking about like World War III, and it's like, ha ha. But like, sure, the means are fine, but like, there's a human toll to all this. It's not just America going to war. Like, it's another 500,000 or 1 million dead people in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Like children and people with families. Mm-hmm. And so like a big part of this album is like learning to just look beyond, you know, for myself, as a songwriter, but then hopefully, you know, other people listening to it, just like looking beyond our own kind of self-interest, and realizing that like the suffering we feel is kind of universal. Like, again, like I tend to try to make a joke out of things because sincerity is uncomfortable, but like, we're on a sinking ship all together, so we might as well like at least recognize that we're in it.
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of like ties into one of the last things I was going to ask, just about kind of like the general, like as a whole, I feel like you as a songwriter don't have a problem kind of like embracing like the negativity and sometimes like the self-depreciation and stuff, but there's kind of like always like a tinge of like a muted positivity. And is that something that you have to kind of like make a conscious effort to include, or is that just kind of like part of how you are as a person?
No, like I really do think of myself as an optimistic person. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't, and I wouldn't do this if I wasn't. Like being in a band, especially, like, you have to be almost delusional to want to do this a career, because it's like, this isn't a job. Come on, this is silly. But it's great, and it's a gift at the same time. But no, I think it largely comes through. I mean, it's something I definitely focused on more on this album. I'm glad you said that. I like sent out. So like when this went out to like the press team for the label, I sent over like a notes document, and in the bio too, like the interview that they did, that Evan did when he wrote our bio, I was like, this is an optimistic album. Like, certain people have laughed at me, and I'm like, no, but really it is. And so, you know, I think part of it just comes from the fact that, yeah, like we can be a very negative band, but I also think that a lot of times when I'm writing stuff, I'm being a bit sardonic, or, you know, like trying to make a joke of things, but it doesn't necessarily come through. So I think that's where I get into trouble sometimes. But yeah, I think it was important to me on this album, especially like Schmaltz. It's fine if you walk away feeling deflated, because that album was about how I'm a piece of shit. You know what I mean? Like, that's fine. We can point at me and call me a piece of shit. That's great. But now that we're like broadening the scope of what we're trying to do, and I'm talking about people who aren't me, like, we don't get to walk away from this calling other people a piece of shit. You know what I mean? Like, we don't get, like, you don't get to walk away from Kick and be like, oh my God, how could you abuse heroin? Like, what the fuck? Or you don't get to walk away from Generation Lost and be like, oh, what? Oh man, it drives me insane when people call people who take their lives cowards. Like, oh, he took the easy way out. It's like, get the fuck out of here. Like, who do you think you are? So I think that was pretty important to, like, there's no coming away from this, like, feeling deflated, because then we're feeling down on everybody's choices and their life. Like, life's hard, and your choices reflect the, like, cruelty of the world. So, like, let's try to put a positive spin on that. And there's got to be some comfort in the fact that, you know, life is long and difficult. So, like, it's not necessarily your fault, you know? And to me, that's positive. Like, absolution is a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess, kind of like piggybacking off of the idea of like expanding the scope of the album, I think that kind of like fits in well with the, what I always have as like my last question, which is just, kind of either for like looking for like a piece of advice, or like, something you've been thinking about, something like philosophical, whatever you kind of like has been hitting home with you lately, either about like music or life in general, that you would just kind of like to share.
Oh, that's fun. That's a good question. I've been so consumed with this album that I think it has to start and stop there, you know, of like, oh, how do I phrase this? You know, when we first started writing the album, I remember reading this great quote from Scott from Frightened Rabbit, who was like, when they started getting a little bit bigger, he's like, nobody wants to hear you complain about sitting in the back of a van. That wasn't it exactly. That was basically what it came down to. Mm-hmm. And so I've been thinking a lot about that. And like the amount I complain about how difficult, life feels sometimes. And, you know, one of the beautiful things that we've got to experience is meeting other people who also feel like their life is a constant, like a never ending chain of events that lead to disappointment or sorrow or hopelessness or, you know, in knowing that like for the large swath of us, like the 99% of us, you know, not in the economic sense. I mean, it's all in the economic sense, but like also in like a more statistical sense, which probably they're probably related. Life is just hard and full of difficult choices and disappointments. And, you know, maybe there's some peace in that. Like if everybody's in a weird way, if everybody's struggling, like we can come together and realize that and try to empathize a little bit more. So I don't know. I usually try not to get into these things because I feel like it sounds cheesy, but I've been feeling pretty good lately. So like I've been trying to be a bit optimistic and try not to let, you know, try not to let the blues get me down. So I think that kind of helps. And like, it also helps that people want to listen to my band. So like, that's pretty cool. It's a good time. It's a good time to be me, like, in a really cheesy way. Like, it's kind of cool. So it was good to be able to kind of come through these songs and kind of see that and now get to kind of experience it and, you know, try to, I think like I jokingly said this in our pitch, but it was like we just want to make the world like less shitty for 40 minutes. So if we can do that, that's awesome. And I feel like that's a good way to try to, that's kind of how, yeah, let's leave it on that. That's how I've been getting through is like going from thing to thing that make the world feel less shitty.
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, that's a great sentiment and a great way to wrap this up. And I really appreciate you taking the time and I'll be at two of the dates on the Wonder Years tour, so I'm super excited to. It'll be the first time I catch you all live, so I'm really excited for that, and that's obviously the Wonder Years too.
That's the first one to catch.
Yeah,
we're so freaking lucky that they are kind enough to take us on tour. We're so like them and the Menzingers. It's so funny. Like, I'm not a big internet. Like, I don't love the internet. But I do hear about these things, so it's a very funny troll to me that the two bands that people accuse us of ripping off are the two bands that we get to go on tour with to launch this album, which to me is our own album. Like, this is us. Like, this is our sound. This is us doing what we do. So to me, there's like a level of trolling that I really, really get excited for. So I'm so psyched for these shows. Also because we get to watch like amazing bands every night. Like, who wouldn't want to tour with the Menzingers and the Wonder Years and Free Throw and Cool Kids and Mannequin Pussy? Like, it's like top to bottom. I can honestly say I enjoy all of those bands that we get to spend the next 3 months with. So like, that's pretty cool.
It's the first tour that I'm ever seeing more than one date of. And it works out perfectly because Boston's right at the start of the tour and Connecticut's right at the end.
Oh yeah. So you get like a month break with the same tour. Oh my God. Okay. So here's what I'm going to need from you. I'm going to need you to really pay attention to how much better we are in Connecticut than the Boston date.
Will do.
Like, by the time we get to Connecticut, it'll be a month of touring, but like a month of touring and maybe three or four of the new songs. So like by the time we get to Connecticut, oh man, it's like, that's the end of, like, we're going to be firing on all, you're so lucky to get to watch us at our best. That's a That's a joke. But it'll be interesting.
It'll be just about 10 years since the first time I saw the Wonder Years. The first time I saw them was in Connecticut, and the next time I see them in Connecticut almost 10 years later. So it's just like perfect on all accounts.
On the Upsides tour?
Well, it was right at the end of the year. It was the end of 2010 when Upsides came out at the beginning. They were opening for, it was 4 Years Strong and a couple other people, I think.
Wow. Yeah. Fun fact about me. This will be the first time in 10 years that I've played with the Wonder Years. So that is some little known San Diego pop punk scene, if you knew anything about my shitty old band. Yeah, no, I'm really excited because I got to play with them on some of the Upside shows in my shitty like easycore band that I had joined up with. And at Bloodfest when I got to do bar bands with them.
Oh, right.
I was talking to Dan afterwards. I was like, yeah, that was wild. Haven't done that since 2010. And he's like, holy shit. I remember that shit. It was really funny. The best review I heard of Schmaltz is that it's like what happens when your band doesn't become the Wonder Years or the Menzingers. because like we're all roughly the same age and have been doing this. I haven't been doing it as consistently as them. And that's like, and also like I didn't write good songs when I was 22. But it was really funny. It's kind of coming full circle and like, it's life's wild, man. It's great.
And there you have it. 22 episodes of Flying the Call Down, and who knows how many more to go. If you haven't checked out Spanish Love Songs yet, what are you doing with your life? Go do it now. You'll be glad you did, and you should count yourself lucky if you're able to snag tickets or a record from them. Because to know them is to love them, and more people are getting to know them every day. Brave Faces Everyone is out now on Pure Noise Records, and is sure to be an album title you'll hear throughout the year, including when it comes to those year-end lists. Check back in on Monday for a hint at next week's guest, and remember, if you get it right, you'll be able to hear the episode early. If you have the chance, please give the podcast a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe, and share your favorite episodes with your friends. It means the world to me, and I love putting faces and names to the audience I owe so much to. A special thank you, as always, to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at FlyOnTheCallPod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at FlyOnTheCallPod@gmail.com. Until next time, brave faces, everyone.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app
and subscribe now.